The crime took place in the morning, at the same time as Abby's murder. There was little blood. Nothing of value was taken. It was likely that the killer had spent considerable time in the Manchester house. The implications were clear to everyone in Fall River. An almost identical crime had taken place while the accused murderess was safely locked away in Taunton Jail. One of the best alibis I've ever heard. Attorney Andrew Jennings commented to the press almost gleefully, "Well, are they going to claim that Lizzie Borden did this, too?" Suddenly, there was an alternative theory of the case based on an unsub with similar M.O. who could not possibly have been Lizzie. What could create more reasonable doubt? The prosecution knew what had to be on the mind of every prospective member of the jury pool. Then, on the very day Lizzie's trial was to commence, a Portuguese immigrant in his late teens or early 20s named José Correra was arrested. He had worked as an itinerant laborer for Stephen Manchester and had gotten into a bitter argument with him over severance pay. Apparently, he had returned to the farm to have it out with Stephen, but when he wasn't there, Correra confronted Bertha instead, murdering her in an overkill frenzy. He waited around the house for a while for his main target to return home, but after some time had passed, he reconsidered the situation and left. The fact that Correra was Portuguese, and a Portuguese from the Azores at that, had the same effect on Fall River residents as the Jewish rumors surrounding Leather Apron had had on the East Enders of London during the Whitechapel murders. Poor and illiterate Portuguese immigrants were the lowest and most maligned caste in that part of Massachusetts, so if anyone was capable of such a ghastly crime as the murder of Andrew Borden and his wife, it would probably be one of them. A proper American certainly wouldn't be capable of that. It was later documented that Correra had not entered the United States from the Azores until April 1893, 8 months after the Borden murders. But by the time this information became public, the Borden jury had already been chosen and sequestered. Of course, for everyone else, another subtext remained almost as powerful. If one violent Portuguese immigrant could break in, attack Bertha Manchester with an axe or hatchet in a frenzy of overkill, then wait around for the man of the house to return, another one certainly could have done the same to the Bordens. The trial of Lizzie Borden began on the morning of June 5, 1893, in the Superior Court for the County of Bristol. This was arguably the most celebrated criminal case of the century, rivaling the trials of Dred Scott, John Brown, the Haymarket bombers, even the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. Such was the interest and hoopla this spectacle created. The murders had long since become the prime topic of conversation not only in Fall River, but throughout New England, just as the Simpson-Goldman murders would rivet Los Angeles and the rest of the nation 102 years later. And as would happen with the Simpson trial, the national and world press converged upon the courthouse. Wealthy, prominent people just didn't get hacked to death, and their children didn't get accused of doing it. If this kind of thing could happen to a man like Andrew Borden and his wife, it could happen to anyone. Knowlton, the district attorney of Fall River, was a reluctant prosecutor, forced into the role by Attorney General Arthur Pillsbury, who, at the time, would have been expected to try capital cases himself. But as the trial date approached, Pillsbury sensed pressure building from Lizzie's supporters, particularly women's groups and religious organizations. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, of which Lizzie was a member, publicly proclaimed its unshaken faith in her as a fellow worker and sister tenderly beloved. Likewise, Lizzie's ministers and fellow congregants at the Central Congregational Church, the most socially prominent church in Fall River, thought it impossible that the kind, demure, and dignified woman they knew could have committed such a pair of unthinkable acts. The first day was devoted to selecting a jury, all white male, and then the prosecution presented its case. William Moody made the opening statements for the prosecution, presenting three essential arguments that were to represent the body of his case. That Lizzie Borden was predisposed to murder her father and stepmother and planned to do so, that the evidence would show that she did in fact murder them, and that her behavior and contradictory accounts were not consistent with innocence. Equally important, Moody made clear, was that the defendant had had the time to kill her stepmother while Bridget was washing the outside windows and was not in the house to hear anything. Then, when Andrew Borden came home, Bridget was up in her room in the attic lying down, and, Moody contended, Lizzie was not in the barn but alone on the first floor of the house with her father. Since there was no sign of struggle, the killer was logically someone well known to both victims, who would not elicit any alarm. The only one who fit this criterion, the prosecution maintained, was Lizzie Borden herself. The prosecution called Thomas Kieran, an architect and engineer who was sent in by the government to take full measurements of the Borden house. On cross-examination, he acknowledged that someone could have hidden in the closet in the front hall and not been seen by anyone inside the house. That afternoon, the judges had the jury visit the house to examine the crime scene for themselves. John Morse testified that he had not seen Lizzie from the time he arrived at the Borden house on Wednesday until he returned after the murders on Thursday. He had been an early suspect, but convinced the police his alibi was sound and that he knew nothing about the crime. Interestingly, he was able to give a full and complete account of his own whereabouts at the time of the murders, down to the number of the streetcar he had ridden, the number on the conductor's cap, and the names of everyone he had encountered. It is almost as if he knew he would need to have this corroborating information, and so made careful note of all of it. Bridget Sullivan testified that she had no knowledge of the communication from Abby's sick friend that Lizzie had mentioned. When Robinson asked her if anyone could have entered the house while she was washing the outside windows, she admitted she had spent some time in a corner of the yard talking over the fence to the maid of the neighbors, Dr. and Mrs. Michael Kelly. Crucial to the case was the evidence suggesting a motive. Knowlton and Moody called witnesses to establish that Andrew Borden was intending to write a new will. An old will was never found, nor its existence proven, although John Morse had testified that his brother-in-law had told him he had a will, but then later testified that Andrew had not mentioned one. The new will, according to Morse, was to leave Emma and Lizzie each $25,000, with the remainder of Andrew's $500,000 estate going to Abby. Further, Knowlton developed the additional motive of Andrew's intent to dispose of his farm to Abby, just as he had already transferred ownership of a house occupied by Abby's half-sister, Sarah Whitehead, to her. This was apparently a sore point between the Borden sisters and their stepmother, and they feared it might be handwriting on the wall as to their father's future intentions. Hannah Gifford, a local dressmaker, recalled a conversation with Lizzie in March 1892, in which she had referred to Abby as Lizzie's mother. Lizzie had rebuked her for referring to Abby this way, calling her a mean good-for-nothing. "Oh, Lizzie, you don't mean that," Gifford said, she replied. "Yes," Lizzie countered. "I don't have much to do with her." Bridget testified that in the 2 years she'd been with the Bordens, she'd never heard any trouble with the family, no quarreling or anything of that kind. All in all, however, the testimony about Lizzie's predisposition was ambiguous and contradictory. The relationship between Lizzie and her father could be proven neither cold and flinty nor warm and fuzzy. As is so often the case with human behavior, it depended on who was observing. However, two rulings by the court became crucial to the eventual outcome of the trial. On Saturday, June 10th, the prosecution moved to enter Lizzie's testimony at the inquest. George Robinson objected, since Lizzie had not been formally charged and was therefore not represented by counsel at the time. On Monday, when court resumed, the justices disallowed the introduction of Lizzie's contradicting testimony. Although today the absence of counsel would weigh quite heavily in the defendant's favor, many legal scholars were mystified by the decision. Of the other contradictions that crept into the record, the defense got Dr. Bowen to acknowledge that the morphine he had prescribed for Lizzie could have left her thinking, fuzzy, and confused. The most dramatic moment of the trial took place on the seventh day. Dr. Edward Wood testified about his examination of the victim's stomach contents and said that he had found no evidence of poisoning. He had examined the hatchet head broken off from its handle, the one police felt most likely to have been the murder weapon, and could find no traces of blood. He said that the killer ought to have had considerable blood on his or her person. Remember that Lizzie was seen by Mrs. Churchill within 10 minutes of Andrew's murder. Told he would produce the actual skulls of the victims to show how the blade would have penetrated them, Lizzie fainted. A true lady, too sensitive to countenance such raw displays, she was allowed to leave the room. Certainly the men of the jury would not have held it against her. But that this particular blade had been the murder weapon was only a theory. If the police and prosecution couldn't definitively identify the weapon, then it might have been taken from the house by whoever committed the crimes, leaving a vast gulf of reasonable doubt in one of the key points of the case. On Wednesday, June 14th, the prosecution heard Eli Benz, the drugstore clerk. The defense objected. After hearing arguments from both sides as to the relevance of Lizzie's attempt to purchase prussic acid, the justices ruled that Benz's testimony and the entire issue of Lizzie's alleged attempt to secure poison was irrelevant and inadmissible. There was, however, a chilling account from Alice Russell about a visit Lizzie had made to her on Wednesday, August 3rd, the evening before the murders. She quoted Lizzie as telling her, "I feel depressed. I feel as if something was hanging over me that I cannot throw off, and it comes over me at times, no matter where I am." After telling her friend about the sickness of her father and stepmother, she confided, "Sometimes I think our milk might be poisoned." When Russell had related that comment to the police on the day of the murders, they had seized the Borden milk supply and had it tested. Nothing unusual turned up. Lizzie also mentioned a previous break-in to the house and two break-ins to the barn. She even said she had seen a strange man run around the house. "I feel afraid sometimes that Father has an enemy," she said. Another item was Anna Howland Borden's statement, recalling Lizzie's unhappy description of her home life as the two women returned, along with Anna's sister, Carrie Lindley Borden, from a 19-week trip through Europe that Andrew had given Lizzie as a 30th birthday gift. Some accounts have referred to Anna and Carrie as Lizzie's cousins, but the trial record states that they were not related, though, of course, Borden was a prominent name through this part of New England. Anna Borden's statement said that Lizzie did not want to return to her stifling home life after the freedom and stimulation of the grand European tour. When the defense objected to the introduction of the statement, the judges ruled that the testimony was too ambiguous and did not point directly to ill will against either Lizzie's father or stepmother, so it too was excluded. The defense used only 2 days to present its case. Essentially, they called witnesses to verify the presence of a mysterious young man in the vicinity of the Borden home. The intruder scenario was their alternative theory of the case. They explained away the missing note by suggesting that women did not like publicity, and therefore it was natural that no one would come forward to say she had requested Abby's presence on the fateful morning. The defense emphasized that no blood was found on Lizzie, ignoring testimony that the way the murders were committed, the killer's position relative to the victims, the offender easily could have avoided being spattered. Andrew Jennings tried to get across several points to the jury. Lizzie must be presumed innocent unless she could not be proved guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no direct evidence against Lizzie, and some of the circumstantial links were weak. There was no weapon identified. There was no well-established motive, and nothing in the defendant's character or previous behavior indicated she was capable of violence. Others had the opportunity to enter the house during the crucial time. To counteract the effects of Alice Russell's testimony regarding the burning of the dress, Emma took the stand and said that she had urged Lizzie to burn the dress, a family custom when clothes were irredeemably soiled. This sounded odd from the household of a man so obsessively thrifty as Andrew Borden, actually known to make rags out of old clothes. Emma testified that Lizzie deeply loved her father, that Andrew had worn a ring Lizzie had given him every day for the rest of his life. She insisted that she and Lizzie had been completely cooperative with the police during their examination of the house and had amply demonstrated they had nothing to hide. To most observers, Emma remained something of an enigma. So retiring was she, few photographs are known to exist. She was described as shy, small, plain-looking, thin-faced, and bony, altogether an unremarkable 41-year-old spinster. She was strongly supportive of Lizzie during the trial, although one witness, Hannah Reagan, a day matron at the Central Police Station who had responsibility for Lizzie during the preliminary hearing, had testified to overhearing an argument between the sisters while Emma was visiting Lizzie on August 24th. Emma, you have given me away, haven't you? Lizzie charged. No, Lizzie, I have not, Emma responded. You have, and I will let you see. I won't give in one inch. Oh, Lizzie, I didn't, Emma insisted. Lizzie did not take the stand in her own defense. On Monday, June 19th, defense attorney Robinson delivered his closing arguments, reiterating the points Jennings had made, and dismissing the possibility that Lizzie could have kept changing out of blood-soaked dresses without anyone noticing and getting rid of them without a trace, as would have had to have happened if she had been the killer. Then Knowlton began his own closing arguments, completing them the next day. He painted a word picture for the jury of what he considered the most likely scenario. He had Lizzie killing her hated stepmother, then knowing she could not face her father, she had no choice but to kill him too. After both sides were done, Chief Justice Mason asked Lizzie if she wanted to say anything. For the only time during the trial, she spoke in open court, saying just, I am innocent. I leave it to my counsel to speak for me. The verdict. Justice Dewey's charge to the jury remains one of the most controversial aspects of the entire trial. He instructed them to take into account her fine character and devotion to charitable organizations, and to keep in mind that any single unprovable element in the prosecution's chain of logic is fatal to the government's case, or as he restated even more sharply, if there is a fact established, whether in that line of proof or outside of it, which cannot reasonably be reconciled with her guilt, then guilt cannot be said to be established. At 3:24 on Tuesday, June 20th, 1893, the jury was sworn and given the case. At 4:32 that same afternoon, they announced that their deliberations were completed. Yet another way in which this trial prefigured the O.J. Simpson trial a century later. The verdict was not guilty on all counts. The case remains officially unsolved to this day. Many commentators have stated that the trial and the verdict represented the triumph of law over popular emotion, and if one reviews the actual record of the case, this may well be true. But from every perspective other than the strictly jurisprudential one, the case remains troubling and unsettled, with the more than nagging feeling lingering that in the Lizzie Borden case, justice has not been served. So how would we on the behavioral analysis side evaluate these crimes? And then, once that evaluation is complete, what could we have come up with of a proactive nature that might have gotten us closer to justice? The nature of the crime. If we were consulting on a case such as this today, the first thing we try to do is to define the crime according to several standard criteria and classifications. Some of this might seem self-evident as we go along, but it is important in all criminal investigations to proceed in a logical, step-by-step manner in which each step makes us more confident of the direction in which we're heading. A good, experienced detective takes nothing for granted. It's almost like a pilot's pre-flight checklist. He may have gone over each item a million times, but if he happens to ignore one, and that turns out to be the weak link, then he and his passengers could be headed for disaster. It is too easy, and I have seen this many times, to come to one simple but wrong conclusion, and then proceed off logically from there. You will then, of course, come up with a logical and well-reasoned but wrong answer. First of all, these murders are what we would term personal cause homicides, which simply means acts ensuing from interpersonal aggression. Before we can be secure with this, though, we have to examine the other possibilities. Nothing of value was taken from the victims or the house, which would tend to rule out the felony murder, that is, a murder during the commission of another crime, such as burglary, or the normal criminal enterprise type of homicide. However, we'd have to say that since the victim was a man of considerable means, we must consider that this could have been a contract or third-party killing, or an insurance inheritance-related death. Sometimes there will be a mixed motive, and we should keep both of these in mind as we proceed. Nor does this scenario fit the other two general categories for murder. It does not suggest itself to be a sexual homicide, as we saw with the Whitechapel murders, and there is no evidence of a group cause homicide, which would include cult and extremist murders, hostage situations, or what we refer to as group excitement homicides, in which two or more people commit murder as a result of the spontaneous excitement of the moment. Because of where the crimes took place, we have to strongly consider that they may be domestic homicides, a subcategory of personal cause homicides, and within this subcategory, we have the further refinements of spontaneous domestic homicide and staged domestic homicide. The prime difference between the two is that the latter involves some degree of planning and follow-through. The first killing, determined by both direct forensic and circumstantial evidence, was of Abby. This might have been either a spontaneous or a planned crime. The subsequent killing of Andrew had to have been planned, the prosecution's theory notwithstanding. This gives us some reason to believe the first killing may have been planned as well. In any case, the sustained aggression of the repeated hatchet cuts to the face of both victims, much more than was necessary to cause nearly instant death, is commonly seen in domestic homicides. We believe this to be not only a manifestation of deep-seated and often long-standing anger by the offender against the victim, but also an attempt to depersonalize him or her. In the Whitechapel murders, we can interpret the mutilation of the genitalia and evisceration of the vagina, uterus, and ovaries as an attempt to strip the victim of her sexual identity and power. Here, the facial battery indicates an attempt to strip the victim of actual identity and familiar power. Significantly, Andrew was attacked as he slept. The first blow would have been sufficient to cause death and would have prevented him from crying out and alerting anyone. From the wound patterns on Abby's body, however, it is clear that the killer straddled her during the attack, which means he or she would have had to look straight into the victim's eyes. Victimology. We have examined Andrew Borden's business prominence and his seemingly obsessive, almost ostentatious, frugality. There is no indication he was a likable man. But from what we can gather, despite the frugal nature of the daily lives he imposed on himself and his family, he was moderately generous with his wife and daughters. He did, after all, give Lizzie an expensive trip to Europe for her 30th birthday. He was tidy, reserved, and brusque, but we have to keep in mind that it was the social ethos of the day that males worked hard to support the family and, in turn, were expected to rule that family. This was especially true in New England. Ever since the house had been robbed in the summer of 1891, Andrew had kept his own bedroom locked, although he left the key in plain sight on the downstairs mantel. This may seem strange until we look further into the family dynamics. Though it was never proven, Andrew suspected Lizzie of having been the burglar. This wasn't just an idle speculation. For some years, Lizzie had had a quiet reputation around town as a kleptomaniac. The local merchants would discreetly present invoices to Andrew for what she had taken, and he would discreetly pay them, avoiding any taint of public scandal. As far as we can tell, this habit was never mentioned in the Borden household. It is likely that locking the bedroom door but leaving the key in plain sight was a silent communication to Lizzie. How much of Lizzie's behavior was acting out to get her father's attention is open to psychological interpretation. Andrew had married his first wife, Sarah Anthony Morse, in 1845. Sarah died in 1862. Emma had just turned 12. Lizzie was 2.5. 2 years later, Andrew married Abby Durfee Grady, a shy, squat, heavy, and humorless woman from a family nearly as prominent as the Bordens. Abby was 36 years of age and had never been married. Andrew was a rigid, obsessive-compulsive, and together with Lizzie's behavior, there has been speculation that his traits match those of a sexual abuser, and hers match those of a woman victimized. Certainly he kept his family socially isolated, and his driving force seemed to have been having power and control over others. His choice of a second wife is significant in that it was as pragmatic as everything else in his life. He opted for a socially prominent but unattractive woman without other prospects, who he could be assured would be grateful and subservient to him, rather than a younger woman who might give him the son he had always wanted. Abby was devoted to her much younger half-sister, Sarah Whitehead, and Abby's generous, eager-to-please personality came out only in the home of her sister. Other than with Sarah and Sarah's daughter, Abby appeared to have no real close relationships. Since the squabble over the ownership transfer of some of Andrew's properties, Lizzie had stopped calling Abby her mother and now called her Mrs. Borden. She wasn't shy about telling friends how oppressive she found her home life with Abby. Prime suspects and motives. Okay, so where do we go from here? The next factor to consider is the relative risk level of the crime. It took place in broad daylight, in a low-crime area, on a street with frequent pedestrian and vehicular traffic of both a personal and business nature. And since this was before the days of automobiles, such traffic would be relatively slow. Moreover, we know from Bridget Sullivan's account that the door Andrew Borden used to gain entry to the house had been locked and bolted. Is it possible that an intruder gained entry through an unlocked door and then locked it behind him to keep others away? Highly doubtful, because an intruder's primary concern is going to be how to get quickly out of the premises. Bridget herself had trouble with the bolt. This would not have allowed for a quick getaway. Since we've ruled out professional or amateur burglary, what other type of offender might take the kind of risk this crime entailed? If the stakes were high enough, or the payoff sufficiently worthwhile, a contract killer might take such a risk. We could, off the tops of our heads, come up with a scenario in which any of the numerous parties with whom Andrew Borden had business might have had a reason to want him out of business. But there are two problems with this. First, investigators found no such animosity. Andrew was a hard-driving, tight-fisted businessman, but no one was out to get him or found to have profited significantly from his death. Second, a contract killer would have had no conceivable reason to kill Abby. So if the unsub got to the Borden home expecting Andrew to be there and found he was not, he would simply have gotten the hell out and waited for another opportunity. There is, of course, one exception to this logic, and that is if the reason for the murders had to do with insurance and or inheritance. In that case, Abby is a critical target. And in that case, who would have had reason to put up the contract? The suspect population is small. Emma, Lizzie, and possibly Abby's half-sister, Sarah Whitehead. We can reasonably eliminate Sarah. Not only did she and Abby have a close relationship, she had no problem with the Bordens. Andrew had deeded over some of his property to her already, and there were indications of more, a fact that the Borden sisters were said to have resented deeply. Also, even if Mrs. Whitehead had decided to do in her sister for her inheritance, she would have needed Andrew to die first, so that according to law, Abby would have first inherited her husband's estate. As it was, with Abby dying first, the estate would go to his heirs, namely Emma and Lizzie. And this is exactly what happened. It cannot be by chance that Abby was killed first. Which leaves the two sisters and a believable motive. But if Emma and or Lizzie was going to hire a contract killer, wouldn't the trained professional have made the crime look like a robbery, or at least the clear work of an intruder? What would be the point of hiring a contract killer, but then having the crime scene and circumstantial evidence point right back to Lizzie? Unless it was Emma who hired the killer, and her intention was to set up Lizzie so that Emma would get the entire estate. But that's really getting excessively complicated. There is nothing in Emma's personality to suggest she could be this Machiavellian. And more to the point, when she had the perfect opportunity to cut her sister loose after she was arrested and indicted, Emma stood by her and insisted Lizzie did not commit the heinous killings. Given all of the foregoing, I'm ready to eliminate the contract killer scenario and move on. Okay, so no robber burglar, no hitman. What about a disorganized offender? The rumors about a crazed madman were rife. Maybe he broke in and could even have hidden himself in the downstairs closet for the hour and a half between the murders. But not after the rage and overkill demonstrated with Abby's murder, and not before the rage and overkill that would be demonstrated again on Andrew. Nobody with that kind of seething turmoil inside is going to be able to control himself to that extent for that long. I've never seen or read about anything like it. Even waiting out in the open for Stephen Manchester to return home after the killing of Bertha, José Correa gave up and left. And this was someone with a discernible grudge. Given the physical setting, too, I would be extremely surprised to see a disorganized offender leave no blood trail between the upstairs murder site and the one downstairs. Certainly there would have been blood traces in the closet in which he would have hidden. So what I'd be telling local police is the same conclusion they came to themselves. This is probably the work of someone close to the family, with knowledge of their comings and goings, with knowledge of the layout of the inside of the house. Someone whose presence would not arouse suspicion. So is there anyone of this description who had motive for the murders? We could make cases for Emma, Lizzie, and Bridget. And of those, who had access and opportunity between 9:30 and 11 a.m. on August 4, 1892? Because of Emma's trip to Fairhaven, we're down to Lizzie and Bridget. What was Bridget's possible motive? What was the precipitating stressor? She wasn't feeling well that warm and humid morning. She'd been vomiting and was weak from her ordeal, and yet Abby insisted she clean all the windows in the house inside and out. Maybe she just cracked, lost it. The 2 years of domestic oppression caught up with her, and she took out all of her frustration and rage on the hapless Abby. She could then either run away or stick around and complete the job on Andrew when he returned home, and make it look like an intruder. But then, wouldn't she have killed Lizzie, too? Leaving her alive would have been more dangerous than leaving Andrew alive. And we have another problem with this. Bridget liked her job. She wanted to be able to keep it. There is no indication that she ever had a serious disagreement with her employers. They got along well, and Mr. and Mrs. Borden treated her with respect and consideration. They even called her by her proper name, something Emma and Lizzie couldn't be bothered with, calling her Maggie rather than Bridget. What about Lizzie and Bridget in collusion? One or both of them kills the Bordens, Lizzie inherits a fortune and pays Bridget off for her troubles. Again, we have to deal with personality, and there didn't seem to be anything in Bridget's that would allow her to take that bold a step. She would have been too scared. The police found her quite timid. Nothing indicates that she would have been motivated to commit such a crime for any amount of money. If Bridget had been involved, a vulnerable young servant with her personality would have broken under interrogation, particularly with the intimidation tactics the police would have used back then. That said, Bridget had to have suspected Lizzie. She was the only other one there, and Lizzie had pointedly brought up the cloth sale, likely in an attempt to get Bridget out of the house. Although Emma seems to have been out of town during the murders, she has not avoided suspicion. After she received the telegram from Dr. Bowen, she did not take the first train back from Fairhaven. She did not take the second, nor the third. The fourth train did not get her back until the evening. This does not indicate conspiracy to me, but I sure wouldn't discount it as a possible indication that as soon as she heard about the murders, Emma had at least a vague fear about what had really happened. The same could be said for Uncle John, who strolls back and, despite the activity on the street, stands around the backyard eating pears that have fallen from the trees. Frank Spearing, who in Prince Jack proposed Prince Eddie, the Duke of Clarence, as Jack the Ripper, weaves a scenario for Emma as the killer of her father and stepmother in Lizzie. He has her establish her alibi 15 miles away in Fairhaven, then surreptitiously driving her buggy back to Fall River, hiding upstairs in the house, committing the murders, then driving back to Fairhaven. Once Lizzie is accused, the sisters work together to protect each other. However, at one point it seems that Emma is trying to double-cross Lizzie, and Lizzie forces her to share the inheritance equally. The problem with this scenario is that there is absolutely no evidence to support it, only that it could have happened. To me, this is a perfect example of the common tendency to make the facts fit the theory, rather than the other way around. All of the behavioral evidence concerning Emma, all of it, suggests she was shy, self-effacing, timid, and dominated by Lizzie. There is no way she could have come up with such an elaborate plan to kill her father and stepmother. Another theory concerns Andrew's alleged disturbed, illegitimate son, William Borden, by a local woman named Phoebe Hathaway. Author Arnold R. Brown makes a case for William as the killer in his interesting and provocative 1991 book, Lizzie Borden, The Legend, The Truth, The Final Chapter. According to the William Borden theory, he was making demands of his father, who was drawing up his will. These demands were rejected by Andrew. William, in a fit of rage, killed Abby first, hid in the house with Lizzie's knowledge, then killed his father. Because of his illegitimate status and a possible claim he might have to Andrew's estate, Lizzie, Emma, Uncle John, Dr. Bowen, and Attorney Jennings conspired to keep his crime hidden. The conspirators then either paid William off, threatened him, or both. They decided that Lizzie would allow herself to be a suspect and be tried for the murders, knowing she could always identify the actual killer should that become necessary. William apparently was fascinated with hatchets and may have had a connection to the Bertha Manchester murder. Arnold Brown questions whether it might have been a contract murder to divert guilt away from Lizzie. As intriguing as this theory may be, there doesn't seem to be any evidence to support it. In fact, Leonard Rebello, author of the comprehensive and exhaustively researched Lizzie Borden Past and Present, writes, "No information was located to substantiate Mr. Brown's allegation." The behavioral evidence regarding Lizzie, on the other hand, has been well documented. Lizzie. Let's take a look at Lizzie's situation. From photographs, she had been rather cute as a child and teenager, but by the time in question, she had matured into what can be most delicately described as a rather plain, round-faced, robust woman. Not exactly like the late actress Elizabeth Montgomery, the talented beauty I remember from the TV movie about Lizzie. She was an unmarried spinster living in her father's house, not getting along with her stepmother, with no real prospects of getting out or changing things. The same can be said for Emma, but Emma was not the kind of outgoing woman with high social expectations that Lizzie was. Since their mother's death, Emma had essentially dedicated herself to caring for Lizzie, a promise she had made to her mother on her deathbed. Lizzie was willful and stubborn and liked to be noticed, which would almost surely have put her into conflict with her father. At the inquest, she often displayed a belligerent temper. She dropped out of school in the 10th grade, was subject to black moods, and indulged in numerous remedies to deal with them. She desperately wanted to live in the style to which she felt her family's social station entitled her, and that began with a house on The Hill, by far the best neighborhood in town. The people Lizzie envied there were largely her rich cousins who had inherited their wealth for two generations running and had no compunction about spending it. Her father, who had scraped for every penny, however, had no interest in such pretensions. He gave Lizzie a generous allowance, and Lizzie had all the fine dresses she wanted, but Andrew thought the house at 92 Second Street was perfectly adequate for their needs. If he wouldn't go for electricity and modern plumbing, he certainly wasn't going to relocate his family to a grand house on the hill. Lizzie was in a bind. She yearned to move out and live in a socially prominent manner, but she certainly couldn't afford to do that on her own, and even if she could, it was so socially improper for a single woman of her class not to live at home while her parents remained alive that had she moved out, she would not have been accepted by the society she so craved to join. The real hope would be marriage to a well-to-do gentleman. But she was 32, so that didn't look likely. She had had a few beaux over the years, but all of the relationships had been short-lived. The men in her neighborhood were all working class, and she couldn't very well have the young men who lived on the hill come calling in her embarrassing house. And the situation might have been getting desperate. Andrew had already turned over real estate holdings to Abby and her half-sister as early as 1887, 5 years before, and Lizzie and Emma both feared they would increasingly be cut out of their father's estate. If that was the case, then they would be at Abby's mercy when the already 70-year-old Andrew passed on. We know that the night before the murders, Andrew and John Morse discussed business with each other in the first-floor sitting room. There is some indication Andrew was seeking advice about his will. So whether or not Lizzie had been gradually trying to poison her parents, this discussion with Uncle John could have been the precipitating stressor that made the act urgent. Once there was a will bequeathing everything to Abby, it would be too late. Did a will actually exist? We'll never know. None was ever found, though it is difficult to imagine a man as meticulous as Andrew Borden not having one. Perhaps the stained dress was not the only thing burned. Strong evidence suggests that at least at one time Lizzie and Andrew were close, though his marriage to Abby would have made their relationship emotionally complicated at best. He constantly wore the ring Lizzie had given him as a sign of her love and devotion. Father and daughter had gone on frequent fishing trips together while she was growing up, and she maintained a passion for fishing, though she had not been in 5 years. This fact made her story about going into the barn to make sinkers somewhat suspect. Another story believed by case scholars to be apocryphal offers an interesting possible precipitating incident in May 1892. Some say Lizzie kept pigeons roosting in the barn, which had recently been broken into. Andrew surmised that the culprits were boys wanting to steal the pigeons, so to thwart them, he went into the barn with a hatchet and killed all of the birds, leaving a bloody hatchet for all, including Lizzie, to see. The symmetry with the murders 3 months later seems almost too neat and facile, but we certainly can't ignore the possible influence if the first event occurred. At the very least, it would show two people apparently unable to deal with each other's emotional needs or sensibilities. I don't think it is going too far to say that in many ways Lizzie saw herself as a victim. Under the section on staged domestic homicide in the Crime Classification Manual, we wrote, "Post-defense interviews of close friends or family members often reveal that the victim had expressed concerns or fears regarding his or her safety, or even a sense of foreboding." If Lizzie had somehow transposed the roles of attacker and victim in her mind, then the anguished visit to Alice Russell the night before the murders fits perfectly into this emotional context. In late July of 1892, Lizzie accompanied Emma to New Bedford, Massachusetts. By some accounts, they left home after a family disagreement over a suspected transfer to Abbey of one of the Swansea farms they had often visited as girls. They were on their way to see friends, Emma to the Brownells in Fairhaven, and Lizzie to some acquaintances in Marion. But in New Bedford, Lizzie decided to spend several days with an old schoolmate before returning home on August 2nd. By then, Andrew and Abby were complaining of stomach upset, and Abby would then go to Dr. Bowen with the notion that someone was trying to poison them. Note again the just-mentioned passage from the Crime Classification Manual. It was the next day that Lizzie was seen in the drugstore trying to buy prussic acid for another try, and that night that she visited Alice Russell. The Behavioral Case. The personality and the pre-offense behavioral indicators are there. Let's look at the crime scene indicators. Lizzie claimed to have discovered her father's freshly slain body, but did not leave the house. Instead, she sent Bridget out and called a neighbor over, even though she would have to presume the killer might still be inside. Mrs. Churchill reported no expressions of fear for their immediate safety by Lizzie at this time. Likewise with the first murder, Lizzie said she believed her stepmother had just returned home and asked Bridget, ultimately accompanied by Mrs. Churchill, to go look for her upstairs. With a crazed killer still in the house? Lizzie made no move to flee the house or to get the others out to safety, nor did anyone suggest to Dr. Bowen or arriving police officers that maybe the killer was still in the house. In domestic murders, the killer often sets up someone else to discover the body, rather than having to find it him or herself. To assume an intruder, we have to deal with all the implications of someone coming into the house, staying there for more than an hour and a half, and not alerting any family members. This guy would have had to have had the stealth and assassin skills of a Navy SEAL. From my experience, there is no way a stranger off the street would have come in and gone straight up to the second floor. He wouldn't have known who was inside, what the environment was. He would have been afraid of being trapped. Even a maniac wouldn't hang around for 90 minutes, and he would have killed Lizzie and Bridget, too. No one is going into that house without some critical information, and this is a subject with which we'll also deal in the next chapter. As we've said, no note to Abby was ever found, even though Lizzie and Emma offered a substantial reward for it. The story about Abby's going out would have been necessary to keep Andrew from going upstairs to see her when he returned home. Normally, in a domestic homicide, we expect to see some effort at staging the crime scene to make it look like a rape or robbery gone bad, or something else that would suggest an intruder rather than someone from the house or family. I think the reason we don't have that staging here is because with Bridget in and around the house, Lizzie knew there was too much of a chance she would be seen doing this. Also, to make it look like a robbery, she'd have had to take something, and if she was remaining in the house, what would she do with it? She had to know the house would be thoroughly searched. The crime scene photograph of Andrew Borden shows his wool overcoat folded on the arm of the sofa, as if he had been using it as a pillow. While it is possible that he did this, it would have been completely out of character. He was as meticulous about his clothing as he was about everything else, and it's unlikely he would have wrinkled a coat he would then wear again on his afternoon business rounds. Is it possible, we have to wonder, that he had actually hung it up or left it draped over the back of a chair, and that the killer put it on to avoid being spattered with blood? Then, once the deed was done, folded it to appear as if Andrew had been using it as a pillow so that the blood could easily be explained? And who would need to avoid the blood? Only someone who was not planning on getting away from the scene immediately after the murders. And what of the rest of the blood? There is, of course, the dress Lizzie burned in the stove, which she could have been wearing during one of the murders. It is also possible that she stripped naked to carry out the murders and then quickly washed herself, though I would wonder about a woman of that era with the social pretensions Lizzie had, taking off all her clothing in this manner, not to mention the risk of being seen by Bridget. In some ways, that is more difficult to conceive of than the murders themselves. Bloody water was seen in a wash basin in the house, but when Dr. Albert C. Diedrich, a Fall River physician who also examined the Bordens' bodies, asked about it, he was told that one of the other doctors or police officers had washed his hands in it after touching the crime scene. That same afternoon, Officer William Medley noticed a pail of water in the wash cellar containing small towels that seemed to be covered with blood. She asked Lizzie about it, and she replied that she had explained it all to Dr. Bowen. Bowen, in turn, assured Medley that it was all right, implying that the pail contained menstrual rags, a subject about which men were exceedingly squeamish. No one was going to examine Lizzie to determine if she was actually having her period, and no one checked the potential evidence of the pail. Lizzie said it had been there for 3 or 4 days, although Bridget claimed she had not seen it before that day. It probably would not have been there 2 days before, or Bridget would have noticed it when she did the washing. When it came to the trial, the idea that the pail contained menstrual rags was accepted as fact. George Robinson reminded the jury that Professor Wood said he would not undertake to say that the blood was not menstrual blood. You know enough in your own households, you know all about it. You are men and human. You have your own feelings about it. I am not going to drag them up, but you must not lose sight of these things. And no one did. Strategies. So if you believe Lizzie Borden to have been the killer of her father and stepmother, is there anything that could have been done in the investigation or trial that might have brought about a verdict to that effect? Based on the experience we've had in many cases within the investigative support unit, I think that there is. Of course, as in the Whitechapel murders, this presupposes an understanding of criminal behavior and practice that hadn't been developed at the time. But if it had, could we have gotten Lizzie to crack? The first thing I would have tried was to play on the strain in Lizzie and Emma's relationship as perceived by the prison matron. One way to accomplish this would have been to befriend one of the zillions of reporters who were haunting the town and given him an accurate but pretty generic evaluation of the case. I would have told him that it has been our experience that in a crime of this nature, there would have been a primary offender, but also a secondary person, almost a compliant victim who was dominated by the subject, who knows exactly what happened, and who should now be very concerned for her own well-being. We would be trying to drive a wedge into the psychological master-slave relationship. The dominant individual will want all of the money and control. The loyalty in the relationship is one-sided. Since this person has shown the capacity to kill twice in cold blood, he or she could easily kill again. And even if she does not resort to violence, she could easily turn on her benefactress and point the finger at her. I'd make sure my target had seen the newspaper articles before I attempted to interview her. They would confirm a fear that was already in her mind. Important to this strategy would be trying to keep Emma away from Lizzie, since Lizzie's personality was so dominant. And I would try this not only with Emma, but with Uncle John as well, since we couldn't be sure which or if both of them might have had inside information or harbored fears about Lizzie. Of course, I would take a shot with Lizzie, too. In situations where the subject is facing a possible capital murder conviction, getting an outright confession is going to be difficult. He's got nothing to gain and everything to lose by telling the truth. So we try to offer some sort of face-saving scenario that the subject can buy into. As readers of Mindhunter will recall, Larry Jean Bell, the brutal and psychologically sadistic abductor and killer of 17-year-old Sherry Faye Smith and 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick in Columbia, South Carolina, was hunted down and caught through an efficient combination of profiling and first-rate police work. Sheriff Jim Metz and his detectives knew they had the right man, but he was understandably unwilling to confess to these despicable acts that could, and ultimately did, get him an appointment with the South Carolina electric chair. So they gave me a crack at him. I gave him some background on the serial killer study we'd done in the FBI, how we'd gone around to the penitentiaries and learned from the actual killers what was going on in their minds. The problem for us, Larry, I explained, is that when you go to court, your attorney probably isn't going to want you to take the stand, and you'll never have the opportunity to explain yourself. All they'll know about you is the bad side, nothing good, just that you're a cold-blooded killer. We found that very often when people do this kind of thing, it is like a nightmare, and when they wake up the next morning, they can't believe they've actually committed this crime. All the time I was talking, Bell was nodding his head in agreement. I knew if I asked him outright about the murders, he'd deny it, so I leaned in close and asked, "When did you first start feeling bad about the crime?" And he said, "When I saw a photograph and read a newspaper article about the family praying at the cemetery." Larry, as you're sitting here now, did you do this thing? Could you have done it? He looked at me with tears in his eyes and said, "All I know is that the Larry Jean Bell sitting here couldn't have done this, but the bad Larry Jean Bell could have." I would think a similar tactic might have worked on Lizzie. I'd start by playing on the blood, asking her where it all went, how she washed it off, how she had to burn that dress. She would have been more sophisticated than Bell, so the approach would have had to have been commensurate to her intellectual level, but it might have gone something like this. "Lizzie, we know from our experience and research that this type of act is unlike a woman, certainly unlike a woman of your standing and upbringing. So if you were involved, we know that there must have been strong and compelling factors that drove you, factors over which you had no conscious control. We can only imagine what it must have been like to lose your mother when you did, then having to live with Abby all those years. We know how manipulative she must have been, how she took advantage of your father, how she subtly turned him away from you and Emma. Emma cared for you and protected you, and now you realize the time had come for you to care for and protect her, to assure her future, and yours, after your father passed on. I know I'd have her attention. She'd be quiet, listening carefully, evaluating what I was saying, trying to figure where I was coming from and how it would affect her. If I were dealing with an innocent person, I'd expect a series of strong denials to practically every statement I made, but Lizzie would be receptive as I reeled her in. And what about your father? We know he tried to love you as much as he was capable of, but think back. Rip off the scar tissue of the old wounds. Is it possible that he loved you too much, or in the wrong way? You were so much like your mother, a woman he adored far more than he could ever care for Abby. And is this something Emma knew about? Something she saw? You may have repressed this. I know how painful it is, but I've seen other cases like this, and I know what can happen. I understand. People say you haven't shown enough grief, but when I see this, I know there's a reason. What has he done to you? We can't change the past, Lizzie, the distant past or the recent past, but what we need to do is to get people to understand why you did what you did. I'm going to leave a pad of paper with you, and if and when anything comes to mind, I want you to write it down. Sometimes that's the easiest way. Then I'd go away and give her time to build her story, but before I left, I'd add something to the effect of, "Lizzie, the person who did this doesn't need punishment. She needs help. She doesn't need to be in a prison. She needs to be in an institution. She might have been disdainful of this approach to begin with, but if I could keep the dialogue going and get her involved, I'd have confidence something useful might emerge. Another variation of this technique would be to try to get another newspaper article out. This one would be an interview with me, touting me as the outside expert brought in to consult with the police. But in the interview, I'd concede disagreement with some of the investigators and within the department itself. I'd say that most of the detectives feel this was a well-planned, cold-blooded assassination-style crime, but I believed it was impulsive, that it represented suddenly uncontrolled rage, that the subject was literally out of her mind for those brief moments. I'd say that many of these acts are like a dream, but there will be one aspect that will make the subject say to herself, "My God, maybe I did do this." This would help plan a defense and build up trust in me and my views for the prospective interview. I'd want her to perceive me as her one possible lifeline. She might not get away with murder, but I might understand. The aftermath. 2 months after the trial, Lizzie and Emma moved into a 14-room light stone house they had purchased at 7 French Street, on the hill. Lizzie named the house Maplecroft, and had the name carved into the top stone step leading up to the front door. Lizzie, who began calling herself Lisbeth, found it impossible to go back to her old church because of the gossip and social ostracism. Emma, on the other hand, remained a churchgoer. Strangely, Prosecutor William Moody received in the mail a package from Lizzie containing official photographs of the trial, including the crime scenes, along with a handwritten note to the effect that she thought he might like them as souvenirs of an interesting occasion. As we would expect from someone whose crimes were situational and directed at close family, Lizzie Borden never committed another known act of violence throughout her life. In fact, she became a great friend to animals and was a fervent supporter of the humane movement. In 1897, Lizzie was charged with the theft of 2 paintings, valued at less than 100, from the Tilden Thurber Company store in Providence. The problem was privately resolved, although a rumor persisted that in exchange for the charges being dropped, she had agreed to sign a confession to the murders of her father and stepmother. The signature proved to be fake. In 1904, Lizzie met a beautiful and glamorous young actress named Nance O'Neill, and for the next 2 years, the two women were practically inseparable. After Lizzie staged a lavishly catered party at Maplecroft for O'Neill's theatrical company, Emma moved out and went to live in Providence. Sometime around 1923, Emma moved to Newmarket, New Hampshire, where she rented a place and lived quietly and virtually anonymously. On June 1, 1927, after complications from gallbladder surgery, Lizzie Borden died in Fall River at age 67. Emma was not included in her will and did not return to Fall River to attend the funeral. 9 days later, Emma succumbed to chronic nephritis. Like Lizzie, she left her estate to a variety of charitable causes. Both sisters were buried in the family plot at Oak Grove Cemetery in Fall River, along with their father, their mother, their stepmother, and Alice Esther, the sister who had died in infancy. The day of the murders, Bridget left the house, never to return. She was rumored to have gone back to Ireland, although this story has never been verified. In the late 1890s, she settled in Anaconda, Montana, where she married a man whose surname was also Sullivan. She did not speak of the Borden murders until 1943, when she contracted a severe case of pneumonia and believed she was going to die. She called her closest friend to her bedside, saying she had a secret to confide. But by the time the friend arrived, Bridget was on her way to recovery and said nothing. The only thing she later told the friend about Lizzie was that she had always liked her. She died on March 25, 1948, in Butte, Montana, at age 73. The house at 92 Second Street in Fall River is still standing. Since 1996, it has been open as a bed and breakfast. The curious or morbidly inclined can actually stay in the John Morse guest room, the site of Abby Borden's murder. That room and the downstairs sitting room where Andrew was killed have been furnished to look just as they did on that warm, humid day in August of 1892. Chapter 3. The Lindbergh Kidnapping. Lucky Lindy up in the sky. Fair or windy, he's flying high. Fearless, peerless, knows every cloud. The kind of a son makes a mother feel proud. Plucky Lindy rides all alone, in a little plane all his own. Lucky Lindy showed them the way, and he's the hero of the day. As these 1927 song lyrics suggest, from a May morning of that year and well into the 1930s, Colonel Charles Augustus Lindbergh was the most famous man in the world. He was in his mid-20s and exceedingly handsome, of solid Midwestern stock, the son of a former U.S. congressman. He was brave, daring, and visionary, yet at the same time modest and shy. And he had done what was supposed to be impossible, flying solo for 33 death-defying hours from New York to Paris in his tiny silver single-engine Spirit of St. Louis. Instantly, he became the Lone Eagle, Lucky Lindy. In short, the ultimate hero, a hero who embodied all of America's best qualities. Then, during a tour of Mexico, this most famous, most eligible bachelor in the world met Ann Spencer Morrow. She was the shy, sensitive, and beautiful daughter of multimillionaire businessman, diplomat, and ambassador Dwight Whitney Morrow, the financial whiz who had taken over as senior partner at J.P. Morgan upon the death of its founder. Charles proposed to Anne, and the American public settled down to live vicariously the lives of its new royalty. The kidnapping of their baby firstborn son instantly became the crime of the century, unquestionably the biggest news story since Lindy's historic flight 5 years earlier. And for many, despite the subsequent atom bomb spy ring, the John and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, the Manson family murders, the slayings of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, and so many other cases, this remains the crime of the century. The facts and the evidence have been so persistently and painstakingly sifted for so many years that there are probably no completely new theories left to present. And like the Whitechapel murders, this case is a perfect example of the emotional tendency to come up with a scenario, then arrange and organize facts and evidence to fit it. What we want to do here is start from the opposite side, the only proper side for an investigator, to work our way through those facts and evidence in an attempt to arrive at an explanation that makes sense, whether or not it conforms to the official record. There are literally millions of pages of accumulated evidence, reports, and testimony, and no one person could possibly go through it all. Keep in mind as you read along, though, that every element presented is or may be significant in determining what happened and who caused it to happen. Like the Ripper case, the Lindbergh case is about the potential for random and unexpected evil to appear at any time. Like Lizzie Borden's case, it is about what can happen behind the closed doors of the most proper and upstanding home. And as much as anything, it is also about the potentially malignant consequences of celebrity and fame. Charles Lindbergh had a complicated and troubled relationship with his own celebrity. He accepted the adulation and the ticker tape parades, the meetings and receptions with world leaders, the endless testimonial dinners, the appointments and commissions and consultancies. An exhibit of his awards and trophies in St. Louis attracted 1 million visitors a year. He understood that his opinion on anything was instant news, and each daring new exploit, whether it was opening up a new aviation route or testing a new piece of technology, only further burnished his gleaming image. And yet he was suspicious of it all, wary of any emotional intrusion, resentful that the press just wouldn't leave any aspect of his existence unexamined. In the midst of a life lived under the unrelenting spotlight of a public's interest and attention, privacy became an obsession for Lindbergh. When they weren't traveling around the world, the Lindberghs lived at Next Day Hill, Dwight and Elizabeth Morrow's palatial estate in Englewood, New Jersey. For their own home, the Lindberghs selected a secluded 425-acre tract of wooded hills in New Jersey's Sauerland Mountains, a few miles from Hopewell. The property overlapped the Hunterdon and Mercer County lines. Lindbergh had spotted the site from the air and thought it would offer the refuge they sought. He also liked that the land was suitable for a private airfield. The couple built a traditional-style $80,000 20-room whitewashed fieldstone house with a thick slate roof and all the modern technological advances. It was designed by Chester Aldrich, the architect of Next Day Hill. Here, Charles and Anne hoped to start and then raise their family. During the construction, they rented an old farmhouse between the property and Princeton. After months of rumors eagerly reported by the press, the world got the news it had been waiting for. On June 22, 1930, Anne's 24th birthday, she gave birth to a 7-pound, 6-ounce baby boy at Next Day Hill. They named him Charles Augustus Lindbergh, Jr., and called him Charlie. But in the headlines, he soon became Little Lindy, Eaglet, or the Baby Eagle. Telegrams, letters, and gifts poured in from around the world. If his father was the Earth's most famous man, Charlie was the most famous baby. Every detail of the baby's day-to-day existence was grist for the papers. In his outstanding 1998 biography, Lindbergh, A. Scott Berg reported that there was a standing offer of $2,000 for any secrets of the household. So thick were rumors that the reluctant Lindbergh felt himself forced to call a press conference in New York to clarify matters. He had personally barred 5 newspaper chains, including Hearst, which had published stories speculating that the baby was deformed or somehow imperfect. When he was asked what he hoped his son might grow up to be, Lindbergh replied testily, "I don't want him to be anything or do anything that he himself has no taste or aptitude for. I believe that everybody should have complete freedom in the choice of his life's work. One thing I do hope for him, and that is when he is old enough to go to school, there will be no reporters dogging his footsteps." The house near Hopewell. The Lindberghs began staying at the nearly completed Hopewell house on weekends, returning to the Morrow compound 50 miles away on Monday mornings. The Lindberghs' full-time staff consisted of an English butler, Aloysius Ollie Whately, and his wife, Elsie. In February 1931, the Lindberghs hired Betty Gow, a recently emigrated Scottish woman of Anne's age, to be Charlie's nursemaid. She had been highly recommended by another member of the Next Day Hill domestic staff. Charlie had developed a head full of golden curls and had his father's distinctive cleft chin, and Anne was pregnant with a second child. She had also begun to seriously consider her goal of becoming a professional writer and had been recording her experiences of her and Charles's recent trip to the Orient. Her chief domestic concern was that, despite their attempts at security, unless the baby was watched every moment of the day, photographers might sneak in and take pictures of him. The narrative of the few days before the crime is well documented by Scott Berg. As had become their custom, during the afternoon of Saturday, February 27, 1932, the Lindberghs left Next Day Hill and drove from Englewood to Hopewell to spend the weekend at the nearly completed house. But by Sunday, little Charlie, now 20 months old, had developed a cold, which left him sneezing, stuffy, and feeling ill. On Monday, February 29th, the baby was still sick, and after lunch, Anne called Betty Gow at Next Day Hill and said they'd stay in the Hopewell house until Charlie was feeling better. That evening, Lindbergh called from New York to say that he'd be spending the night in town and planned to return the next night. He had been pursuing his interest in biological research at the Rockefeller Institute. On Tuesday morning, the baby seemed to be a little better, but Anne herself had come down with a cold. She called Betty Gow again and asked her to come to Hopewell. Gow arrived early in the afternoon and spelled Anne so she could get some rest. A little before 3 p.m., according to Berg, the two women went into the nursery together and found Charlie much improved. He played in the living room until around 5:30, then Gow took him back upstairs to the nursery, which, as you approach the house, was the room in the far left rear of the second floor. Gow fed him some cereal, then around 6:15 Anne came in, and they prepared him for bed. They rubbed his chest with Vicks Vapor Rub, then Gow quickly made a simple undershirt for him out of some leftover cream-colored cotton flannel. They put on his diapers, a woolen vest-style shirt, and a gray size 2 Dr. Denton sleeping suit. Lindbergh did not want him to suck his thumb, so he'd outfitted his son with wire thumb guards at night that clipped onto his sleeves. Betty laid him down in the dark wooden 4-poster crib and pulled up the blankets. Anne tried to close the shutters, but found the ones on the corner window too warped. She left the room around 7:30, and Betty Gow stayed another few minutes, opening one window about halfway for some circulation, before turning out the light and leaving to wash the baby's clothes. After that, she went in again to check on him and safety-pinned the blanket to the mattress to keep him warm. She then went to the basement to hang up the things she had washed and joined Elsie Whately for dinner in their sitting room at about 8 p.m. 25 minutes later, Lindbergh arrived home. Actually, he was supposed to be at a dinner hosted by New York University at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, but there had been a scheduling mix-up, so he had driven home to Hopewell. He came from the garage through the kitchen. He and Anne sat down for dinner together around 8:35. After dinner, they went into the living room, which occupied the central area of the ground floor on the back side of the house. Just after 9 p.m., Lindbergh thought he heard a strange sound, which he later described as similar to a wooden orange crate breaking. He thought maybe it had come from the kitchen on the right front side of the house, in line with the dining room in the back. Anne recalled that about 15 minutes before Charles drove up to the garage, she thought she'd heard the sound of car wheels crunching the gravel of the driveway, but no one had been there. The Lindbergh's dogs, Wagoosh, had not barked at any point, and so Anne had paid little attention. During this time, Betty Gow got a call from her boyfriend, Henry Red Johnson, a Norwegian sailor who was currently working as a deckhand on a yacht. They were supposed to have gone out that evening, but had to cancel the date when Gow was called to Hopewell. Instead, Johnson told her he was going to drive up to Hartford, Connecticut to see his brother. After sitting in the living room for a little while, Anne and Charles went upstairs to their bedroom, which was just above the living room at the rear of the house and connected to the nursery by a short hallway that led past their bathroom. Charles bathed, then dressed again and went downstairs to read in the library, which was next to the living room at the left back corner of the house and directly under Charlie's nursery. Meanwhile, Anne bathed and went to bed around 10 p.m.